pressed by Trump.
Okay, so what's going to happen?
What's going to happen is that the Europeans and others will open new embassies for the Palestinian state, and in spite of all what we can say, that there is no Palestinian state because the Israelis are occupying Gaza and the West Bank and most of them, and building new settlements in the West Bank, but also we will find a political body for the Palestinians in the world that would lead to a kind of recognition of the self first for the Palestinians, that they have state, they have identity, but they have to have a land. So they have to have Gaza and they have to have the West Bank. That would lead to new laws in the international law, that because these countries, China, yes, Russia and Europe, most of the Europe, Australia, I was really surprised that the Australians and other countries, okay, Canada, and yes, who acknowledged this state.
Okay.
I guess we have a new way of dealing with this issue, the Palestinian
okay
issue, with the resistance.
However,
we have to realize the resistance.
However, the suffering of soldiers in the Gaza Strip exceeds their ability to endure after two consecutive years of war in Gaza and other fronts. This led to a shortage in the number of soldiers due to some refusing to return to Gaza, especially reservists. Do you think that Israel is facing a severe crisis in terms of manpower, Doctor?
Yes, absolutely. Especially the Haredim are not going for the army and for the training. And also, most of these people who are committing suicide and refusing the orders to go to the war in Gaza, after what they have seen of the insistence of the Palestinians to fight till the end, because I guess the Palestinians, they have no other way. But for those who are occupying and killing and shooting against the children and the women and the elderly and the people who are in famine, I guess we have also a new stage, time for the Israelis, that they are decaying. As John Mersheimer said, he said it clearly, that Israel is Netanyahu is leading Israel to decadence, to degeneration, to a way that they can't understand what is going on. That's why they describe Netanyahu as a new dictator in Israel, leading Israel to the abyss, to nowhere. They don't know no strategy, as they have said in the first report, no strategy, no political vision, no nothing, in spite of their saying that a new Israel or a greater Israel. There is no greater Israel,
yes,
especially now after what has happened in the region and the insistence of the peoples of the region to fight.
Okay, but Netanyahu now is advertising that this war will enter a new year, promoting
for the Jewish year.
Yes, and speaking about Super Sparter. But how can he pursue such a plan if he lacks enough manpower?
Sparta was negative or anti-Athens. No Alexander, Netanyahu, not an Alexander. Netanyahu has no piece of land to have this war society. And he is in a world, in the Arab world, in the Islamic world, in the what they call civilized world. Yesterday, one of the parliament speaker in Spain said that if the values of the West that Netanyahu claim that he is implementing in the region, they don't want these values. The values of killing, values of massacring people, values of cutting the children, slaughtering the people, most of these values have been unveiled.
Okay, but how?
And when we talk about Israel now, we talk about a scandal.
Okay, despite your own analysis, Dr. Mohsen, meanwhile, some commentators on Israeli social media encouraged the continuation of the war on Gaza by recalling Al-Aqsa flood operation.
Yes, Christmas meet. On October 7, when many people were kidnapped, I never imagined 2 full years would pass without them returning. How many stories has that madman Netanyahu told us? How many lies has he fed us? And yet the captives are still in Gaza. The guy from T. The fighting in Gaza is like beating a carpet. Dust will always come out with every strike. The residents of Gaza have nowhere to go, so Hamas will remain among the population. Gael, the most important thing is to eliminate Hamas and open Gaza for immigration. This is more important now than the issue of the captives with Hamas. Because if Hezbollah had joined on October 7, Israel today would be under the control of Hamas and Hezbollah. Tens of thousands of Israelis would have been sold as slaves throughout the Middle East, and thousands of Hamas elite fighters would be roaming the streets of Tel Aviv today. Wake up, Israelis.
Well, after the aggression against Qatar, all efforts to reach a deal were completely paralyzed. The reason is that both the Qatari and Egyptian mediators so far refused to resume their efforts. And because of the absence of any alternative Israeli proposals to one, it toppled after its aggression on Doha. Does Netanyahu really want to return to negotiations and seek the return of Qatari mediators, in your opinion?
Well, you have to see Trump. You have to see the political thinking of Trump. Yesterday he met some of the Arab leaders, and I don't know what has happened in that meeting, but I guess the Arabs now for new negotiations in terms of their power. Power, well, I don't mean the military power. I mean after the attack on Qatar, now they have this pretext, this cause, this incentive to say no to the Netanyahu's political agenda in Gaza. And the way he wants to stay in Gaza and appoint a new government in Gaza would not lead to any kind of success, especially now even Trump, he feels that the situation now in Gaza is not going the way he wanted.
But do you think that could the Arabs be able to put a certain kind of pressure on Trump to force Netanyahu for a ceasefire or return
otherwise,
to negotiations?
Otherwise, they have mediations. To think about the dangerous situation after what might Netanyahu do in Gaza and concerning especially the greater Israel and the situation in Syria and in Egypt and in the Gulf, in Lebanon, in the West Bank. So we are talking about a mass chaos in that region.
Okay.
If they go along with what Netanyahu wants.
Moving to Egypt. Where the Hebrew media appears to be waging a systematic campaign against Cairo, which began after President Sisi's speech at the Doha summit, in which, of course, he described the entity as the Israeli enemy. In more recent development, Egypt is set to be reinforcing its army at the Sinai borders. Do you think that Egypt is really moving to reinforce its forces in Sinai? And why would it do that at this time?
Well, they are afraid from the Netanyahu's plans about Israel, greater Israel, that Sinai is one of the
But there are treaties
one of
that,
the
that are the treaties signed.
This
that
treaty,
at one point,
who
of this treaty, such as the Camp David, is
treaty,
to preserve power
especially
and maintain
Netanyahu.
Power.
Netanyahu
security.
Never committed himself or his cabinet to any treaty, to any law, to any human law, to any political law, to any treaty in Egypt, in Egypt and in Philadelphia, as is a proof, an evidence for that, an evidence. Also in Syria.
So why
also
are they reinforcing
we are talking, now? We are talking about a mass chaos. Mixing all these strategies in the region, and the Egyptians, they have the right to build a new strategy to confront Netanyahu's way of thinking towards this Sinai and the West Bank and Gaza, and he knows, Sisi knows, and the Egyptian, especially the army in Egypt, want to protect the borders of Egypt. So they have to prepare or to be prepared for any new escalation from Netanyahu. And that's what they are doing on the borders on in their land. So why Israel or Netanyahu or the army, the Israeli army, are making all this fuss because of this situation? I think they are wrong or preparing something against Egypt as they have prepared something against Qatar. So now the Egyptians calculate things in a different manner, especially when they refuse to accept the people from Gaza to go to cross into Sinai and into Al-Arish or any place of
How
important
is this giving Egypt's weight in the region?
Well, Egypt has this weight, but they have to embody it, to represent it, to manifest it to the people and say, we are here. Unless they take responsible decisions in order to curb this greediness of Netanyahu, the Egyptians will not be respected. And that's what Netanyahu tried to do. But now the Egyptians have felt that all the world is against Israel, acknowledging, recognizing a Palestinian state, recognizing the situation in Gaza, in all the parliaments of the world. They have to think, they have to get something from this, to not to win, but at least to be responsible about their borders and about their people and about the emotions and the feelings
yes.
of the Egyptians and the Arabs.
Okay.
They have place, but they have to keep it, to preserve it, to enforce it, to make it solid and represent it to the world. Well, that was probably a good step from Assisi not to go and interview or meet Trump. That was, of course, he was
yes.
afraid from the pressure of Trump, but I guess not going to meet Trump is a positive
step okay.
towards Palestine.
Moving to the war with Iran, the Hebrew media revealed that before the war, Trump offered to hand over to the Zionists Air Force B-2 fighter jets to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities. This was confirmation that Trump was a partner in the decision to launch war on Iran. What's the message behind the Hebrew media actually revealing this information now and saying that Trump carried out the strike on Iran on the behalf of the Israeli entity and advertising for that?
Well, they want to make a kind of share for Trump in this operation, and Trump declared it clearly when he said that without my decision, without my participation, and Iran could have destroyed Israel in 3 days. Well, that was great. And Netanyahu now is saying, well, you gave us the bombs, the Air Force, and we did not accept that to go alone,
mm-hmm.
but along with the Americans. We don't go for such a dangerous situation, dangerous step towards Iran without the United States, because you know that, well, the Saudis and the Gulf state, they have said to the Americans, don't go and bomb Iran. And they want to go together, Netanyahu and Trump, and they share the responsibility against Iran. And every day, Trump is making a statement against Iran and against Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And the leader, the Imam Khamenei, said it clearly. We can't go according to your orders in order to sign what you want. We have interests, we have our dignity, we have our honor, and we are not going for that. So they are really hanged there. They are suspended there. Now the Americans and the Israelis, they don't know. Although they make threats every day against Iran, but I guess they are fearful of any step against Iran after Iran launched many missiles as an experiment. And also because of maneuvers,
yes.
not maneuvers in, well, they have experienced this, In addition to what the Chinese and the Russians, they have
told
the Americans.
So there will not be any new war on Iran, Dr. Mohsen?
I won't say there is any close or we are close to any new initiation of aggression against against Iran. I would say they would have to finish the situation in Gaza and Lebanon, although and in Syria, although the only simple place after the coup d'etat or the what they call the change of the regime in Syria, they are having this an easy situation in Syria, not in Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
nor in Gaza, neither in any place, neither in the West Bank. So they have great problems before they finish the situation or go to peace. As Barak said it clearly, there will be no peace. Neither was there, nor will be, and the situation is going under the threat of the Israelis, and the Israelis now in a great dilemma inside, in terms of situation, the political situation inside this occupation, and also outside.
Okay.
We see in Lebanon the situation is not very dangerous, especially internally. Nor in the West Bank and Gaza, in spite of all these massacres against the Gazans, but they insist to continue their fight against the Israelis. So I guess the situation for the resistance is much, well, let's to say, hopeful and optimistic.
Dr. Mohsen Saleh, President of the International Association of Political Experts, thank you very much for your analysis and thank you for joining us.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا أو يهو بليس استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. I pray all of you are well. We have been discussing the subject of nifaq or hypocrisy. It's important to understand this behavior because when we look at it, we think that these people are like honest to God conniving people. Yeah, honest to God like evil people. Honest to God just like bad people, right? But we have to understand nifaq from an akhlaqi position, right? From an akhlaqi position, like in the study of akhlaq, like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not just want good characteristics, right? Allah Azza wa Jal wants characteristics that are naturally occurring from us. Good characteristics that are naturally occurring, right? And so it's known in akhlaqi literature as a malaka. A malaka is a characteristic that is part of your natural disposition, right? Your natural demeanor. It's something that you don't really have to think hard about. It just comes naturally, right? Like, I don't have to force generosity. I'm just a generous person, right? I don't have to force servitude. Servitude just comes very naturally, right? Like, I love to serve God, His creation, whatever it is. That level of goodness. Now, obviously, in the beginning, we have to force characteristics. We have to force akhlaq. But the aim always is that we should develop these characteristics to the point where they come naturally from me, right? Such people are real, like, beacons of light. When some people just have naturally good disposition, we are gravitated towards such people. We are attracted towards such people. Now, the way a characteristic develops into a malaka is through repetition, yeah? Through constant repetition. So even when I don't feel like it, I'm going to force it because I know that's what God wants, right? Like, how do you think people pray Salatul Layl, right? It's not because in the beginning they have a passion to pray Salatul Layl. Sure, like, I have a desire, I may wake up once, but that desire is not going to be there when I'm tired, right? But you force it until it just becomes natural for you, right? At that point, we have a responsibility then to ensure that that act does not just lose heart in the process, right? And that's like the whole, like, it's like a catch-22 when it comes to iman, yeah? You repeat till it becomes natural. But then human tendency will be that once it becomes natural, I don't have the passion for it anymore, right? Because it's just habitual. And so now I have to bring back the heart at that point. So it's a journey. Life is a journey, right? But until I repeat, it becomes a malaka. Now, this is true not only for positive qualities, but it's also true for negative qualities, right? If I repeat a bad quality over and over and over and over again, that's who I'm going to be naturally, right? People who are just mad all the time. Yeah, people who just get angry all the time. People who just are upset all the time. How? Because that's the habit that they repeated over and over and over again until that characteristic is just now naturally coming out from them. And so if we understand that, these hypocrites, they act this way almost unknowingly. Yeah? It's not that they are purposely vile. It's not that they purposely try to be a hypocrite. It's because they were double-faced for long enough, now they are double-faced even when they don't need to be double-faced. Yeah? You understand? This is something that is why it's called a sickness, right? It's something where they will lie even when there is absolutely no need to lie, right? They will harm even when there's absolutely no need to harm. Like, why? What was the point of a lie there, right? Because it's just something that I habitually do, right? Like, it's just something that naturally comes. Our Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, he's reported to have said, al munafiq, a munafiq is man idha wa'ada akhlafa, wa idha fa'ala afsha, wa idha qala kathaba, wa idha tumina khana, wa idha ruzika tasha, wa idha muni'a asha. That the munafiq is one, when they make a promise, they don't fulfill it. When they do something good, they show off. When they speak, they lie. When they are entrusted with something, they betray it. When they are given sustenance, they are heedless. When they are deprived, they resort to tricks. It's not like they're actively doing these things. It's just their nature. Yeah, it's just their nature. And this is why we have to understand this from an akhlaqi perspective, that I don't think in many instances the hypocrite is just, he's not out to get us. Poor guy, poor girl, just can't help it. That's who they are, right? Now, do they have to develop something? Yes, they have to work on themselves. And that's why I said, like, we just have to look inward. Because when it becomes a malaka, like, I may not even recognize it, right? Like, it's just natural for me. Like, I don't even think it's wrong here. And so we have to be very much reflective. You know, the idea of reflection, like, it's something that I try to teach my madrasa kids who are like 14 or 15 right now. Like, if we learn how to be reflective people from a young age, it really helps us later in life. The problem is we don't reflect enough. And because we don't reflect enough, we are just reactionary. And if we're reactionary, we're not realizing whether my actions are stemming from a good place or a bad place. But if we're people who reflect, like connect the dots, like, why did I do that? Right? Like, why did I say that? Like, where did that come from? Why was I angry? There was no need to be angry. It was something so small, right? Like, why did I create such a big deal? If we can trace it back, man, that's an amazing characteristic. An amazing characteristic. Because when we become reflective, I really think God begins to unveil things for us. Really does. Like a jigsaw puzzle, you know? We can see the pieces coming together. And that's how God guides us. But we just have to be people who reflect like that. And once we do, it's amazing. So, you know, when you look at the act of hypocrisy in general, it's an act that distances us away from God and His Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. Like, they want nothing to do with hypocrites. And this is something that, again, should frighten us. Because, like, we claim to love them, but we want to make sure that we are actually approaching them the way that they want. And the desire has to be honest to be with them.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the hall of shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history.
should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice. Our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kaba Tahwai. We have the pleasure of having with us today Susan Abulhawa. Susan Abulhawa is a Palestinian-American scientist, writer, and activist. Her first novel, Mornings in Jenin, was translated into 32 languages and sold more than 1 million copies. The sales and reach of her debut novel made Abulhawa the most widely read Palestinian author of all time. Now, she was also born to Palestinian refugees of the 1967 war, which makes her that much of an expert on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, especially with the genocide that's going on in the Gaza Strip. Susan Abulhawa, welcome to Unscripted.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. We understand that you went to the Gaza Strip. You said that that changed your life. The totality of the devastation, according to what I read, to have overwhelmed you. And to use your words, actually, quote, it has honestly changed my life in a way that was sometimes difficult to put into words, is what you stated. Now, just recently, you had also the U.S. envoy to the Middle East, or we call it West Asia, Stephen Witkoff, who also visited the Gaza Strip. Do you think he saw what you saw and that it changed his life or impacted or affected it in any shape or form?
I mean, I can't speak for what's in another person's heart, but I do know that Steve Witkoff is a Zionist at heart. I mean, he has a history of exhibiting that. I don't think he wanted to see what I saw. Even if he had an opportunity to do so, he didn't want to. He was happy with the sanitized and very limited version that was engineered for them at the GHF sites. I doubt it. These are committed Zionists. They are Jewish supremacists, and he is one of that network that pervade the U.S. government. And so, no, I don't think our experiences are the same. I went to Gaza as a human being, as a Palestinian, as someone who is concerned with the rights and the well-being and the protection of the most vulnerable people on the earth, who are being literally attacked by the most powerful countries in the world. I went there as a woman, as a mother, as a writer, to collect stories, to bring in aid, to do whatever I could as an individual to provide relief in the midst of what I very early on recognized as an unfolding Holocaust.
One of the statements that came on Witkoff's visit, and I'm using him not in particular just to broadcast him, but rather some of the actions that was described, and in this case I'm going to use statements coming from Hamas, which is quite telling. One of them was that Hamas said that his visit was a show and that it was a propaganda show to quell the growing anger over the U.S. partnership with the Zionist regime, as Hamas calls them, and imposing hunger on the residents of Gaza Strip. Do you think that Hamas has a valid point there?
Absolutely, and they're absolutely right. Israel had a problem with the images that were coming out of Gaza of starving children. So at first they tried to, you know, their propaganda is so ugly. They were saying that, why is it just children starving and their parents seem to be fat, which is of course a lie. But then, you know, there were images of starving, emaciated, skeletal men and women who were also dying. And there were, you know, genocide and starvation scientists and experts who explained that, you know, usually children are the first to become skeletal because they have far fewer fat reserves and tissue reserves. And so the next phase of the propaganda was to claim that the starvation was engineered by Hamas. Of course, everything is Hamas. And what I was told from friends on the ground, that Israel was actually allowing in tiny amounts of food and even fresh fruit food in collaboration with a few corrupt merchants. And they would take their embedded journalists into these places to you know, try and prove that there's no starvation. So Witkoff's trip was just another one of these tricks to obscure the unfolding horrors on the ground. And, you know, they do this, and this is the reason why no international journalists are allowed in. Gaza is a massive crime scene, and they don't want anyone probing it, and they will allow in only enough people to a controlled and stage area in order to push back against the overwhelming forensic evidence that they are starving people to death, that they have been committing a Holocaust, that this is a long desired Zionist aim to remove Palestinians from their ancestral homeland in order to replace them with foreign imported Jews.
Indeed. We're going to get back to the famine issue again because there's lots to cover there. But before that, I have to say that I listened to your speech that happened at the Oxford Union, at UK's Oxford University, and it was really, really moving. I didn't expect that. And I've covered this Gaza wars way back in 2007-08 throughout, and if you're familiar with the station, which I guess you're somewhat familiar, we cover this every day. You know, I've seen the gore, I've seen the shocking images, but it really, and I'm not saying this to just because you're a guest on this program, but there were some very moving statements you made there to describe what is happening, where the title, "This House Believes Israel is an Apartheid state responsible for genocide. That was a conclusion that was reached. But then came the censorship and came the fact that even there were moves to shut down the Oxford Union. Tell us what happened there. What did you say that, well, aside from me, and I'm sure many were moved just like I was, that made them, whoever they are, that maybe you can tell us, to view this as something that should be censored?
So the president of the Oxford Union at the time, Ibrahim Osman Malafi, did not censor the speech, and he uploaded it in its totality because there was nothing illegal, nothing that could not be substantiated. There was nothing. There were no lies. There was, you know, it was everything I said was grounded in documented history and lived experience, and so it was uploaded in its totality, which is why we were able to get that ultimately from the archives after they edited it and uploaded a reduced version where they took out certain statements. The claim was that it was incitement to racial hatred or something like that. For example, one of the lines in there was about the well-documented incidents in Lebanon in the 1980s when Israel dropped or left booby-trapped toys that exploded when excited children picked them up. This is a matter of record, but they removed that. And I think, you know, Israel can say, they can give themselves plausible deniability about collateral damage, you know, about Hamas or Hezbollah, whatever else. But when you leave booby-trapped toys, there is no mistaking the intention of that. There's no mistaking the fact that you are trying to murder and maim children. And so I think that's why they took it out. Now, it's not so. And when I say they, these are the powerful forces that are situated behind the facade of students at the Oxford Union. They are wealthy trustees and Zionists throughout the UK who lobbied the Oxford Union heavily to remove my speech in particular. And we are in a legal battle with them because I don't accept first of all the perversion of my intellectual labor and my intellectual property, and also the perversion of the historic record in service of Zionism, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were so many things that you said that I really want to get more an idea from you in terms of this. Particular setting, so I'm going to go at it, and I picked one that had Benjamin Netanyahu, that you said, a Polish Jew whose real name is Benjamin Milakowski, Milakowski.
Milakowski, yeah,
and,
or however you pronounce.
Yes, once bemoaned a missed opportunity during the 1989 Tiananmen Square, where I guess he said that while the world attention was focused on China, that he wanted to expel large parts of the Palestinian population there. Also, you went on to say there how some of their articulated solutions to the nuance of our existence include a break-their-bones policy in the 80s and 90s ordered by Yitzhak Rubitsov, a Ukrainian Jew, who changed his name to Yitzhak Rabin. But tell us about these two that I picked here. And I know I'm merging this into one, but again, these were what I dissected from your speech there.
So, so Yitzhak Rabin, whose real name is Rubitsov, was the architect of a policy that was dubbed Break Their Bones, in which Israeli soldiers, because the first Intifada was largely nonviolent. I mean, it was children throwing rocks at tanks, basically. But mostly it was civil disobedience. And so the Break Their Bones policy was an order to soldiers to break the bones of Palestinians, to beat them until their bones were broken. There is a horrible, a harrowing video that was filmed clandestinely in the 1980s, showing soldiers who took three young men into a remote area and were stretching their arms out and then, you know, holding them and just beating their arms and legs with stones until they broke. And this video is like 20 minutes long, and it shows the labor, how hard it was for them to do. You know, the soldiers get tired and they go, and it's so. This was a policy. There were so many Palestinian children who would be grabbed by soldiers. Children as young as 3 and 4 years old and 5 years old, they would grab them and they would put their hands on a rock and just crush their hands with rocks, with purportedly the rocks that they threw to teach them a lesson. This was a policy. There's a whole generation. There are generations of Palestinians who've been maimed, whose limbs have been maimed or torn or amputated because of repeated Israeli policies to destroy our bodies.
Indeed. Well,
to make, yeah. So that was the break their bones policy. The other part you mentioned was when Netanyahu bemoaned the missed opportunity during Tiananmen Square. And this was a speech that he gave to university students. I think it was Hebrew University, if I recall, but I might be mistaken about the precise university. But it was a speech he gave to them in the 80s, and it sort of exemplifies how this is, you know, Israel's aim has always been to remove the Palestinians and take their place. That really laments these kinds of missed opportunities, which I think is sort of at the heart of what we're seeing in Gaza. For example, throughout Israeli society, throughout their political life, and especially their academic life, there is this notion that Ben Gurion didn't finish the job. If he had only finished the job and killed us all or expelled us all, they wouldn't be in this situation. There's also, you know, there's this lament as well that in 1967, they should have pushed harder to get rid of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And at every turn, right, in the 80s, people might not remember this, but of course, we Palestinians know this history in our bones, and so do the Lebanese. In 1982, Israel surrounded Lebanon. They cut off food and water and supplies to the city for nearly 3 months, and they bombarded them with bombs in Beirut, to the point that Ronald Reagan had called Menachem Begin and said, look, this is a Holocaust. Ronald Reagan called it a Holocaust. So this is not the first time Israelis have done this. And so Begin was forced to kind of, you know, stop what they were doing. And again, there is still this this notion in the Zionist psyche that if he had just pushed through, right, Lebanon would be northern Israel. This is what they want. This is what they've always wanted. This has always been part of the Zionist plan to take Lebanon, to take Gaza, and get rid of all of us. And this is what I believe is playing out in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu is at the tail end of his life. He has wanted to do this his whole life. He had an opportunity, which I believe they engineered to some extent. I believe they knew there was a plan, and I believe that they wanted to make it as sensational as possible to have early on, if you recall, their propaganda was, this is our 9/11 moment. Mm-hmm. They fully expected to do what the United States did and not be held accountable. to, you know, to bomb their way, destroy and kill, and they made it as sensational as possible, right? They killed their own people. All of those cars that were at the Nova Festival, every single one of them was bombed by their own Apache helicopters. 28 helicopters that had to reload at least once, emptied all their firepower.
Right.
The resistance did not have that kind of firepower on their little motorcycles and mopeds to cause that kind of damage. That was entirely done by Israel. So they killed their own people, and to blame Hamas. And then I'm not saying that Hamas didn't kill people. Of course they did. But we know what Hamas's aims were, and they've articulated that. And that wasn't enough. They had to create these sensational lies about beheaded babies and babies in oven and mass rape. Every single instance of these claims have been thoroughly debunked. And so they lied. They wanted this international uproar that would not.
Sure.
That would just look the other way no matter what they did. But I think they deeply miscalculated. They did not understand the resolve of the resistance, the resolve of the Palestinian people, because colonizers always underestimate the attachment of indigenous people have to their land and to their roots and to their ancestors. And they are encountering this. And he's still pushing through because this is, you know, he's trying to fix what his predecessors didn't do.
Well, they are doing what perhaps what we thought was behind closed doors in terms of a genocide. We thought that some of the statements that we're hearing now is not what was said before, and that right now is when they are coming out in the open day, meaning the Israeli officials. But from what I read through over here, it seems like the genocidal statements was there from way back. For example, you said that there's a new discourse that has arisen, frustrated by Palestinian resilience. This is something that you said, and that was especially after a massive natural gas field was discovered off the northern Gaza, worth trillions of dollars. For example, you mentioned Colonel Ephraim Eitan, who said in 2004, quote, "We have to kill them all." Aaron Sofer, so-called intellectual and political advisor. Again, things that you covered in your speech, that we have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day. And then fast forward to today, in 2025, Minister of Social Equality and Women's Advancement, May Galan of Likud. "I am personally proud of the ruins of Gaza, and that every baby, even 80 years from now, will tell their grandchildren what Jews did." So what we are seeing, this genocide play out, as people are now well aware of the term, in real time.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, when I was in Gaza, when I was, you know, looking around at utterly bewildered, and this was still in 2024, and it has gotten infinitely worse. But when I was there, looking around at people who were just utterly bewildered, disheveled. Hygiene was a problem because of lack of water. Israel bombed all the water resources. And I kept remembering this quote by Raphael Eitan. Also, I think he said this in the 80s, I think 86 perhaps, I can't remember. But he said, when we have settled all the land, all the Arabs will be able to do will be to scurry around like drugged cockroaches in a bottle. Reducing and degrading Palestinians has been a long time Zionist fantasy. And I think that's what they're doing. There is this deep jealousy that they have of the people who truly possess the roots that they covet in the land. They resent the fact that despite their siege, despite the constant bombing that they've done over the years, Palestinians in Gaza still managed to create a beautiful life, to to build, you know, everybody, they keep saying, oh, Palestinians could have built, they could have done this, but actually they did. There were beautiful cafes, even with such limited resources. Palestinians kept education as a premium. There were multiple universities throughout Gaza, and people still sought advanced degrees, medical degrees, PhDs, master's degrees, architectural degrees, art degrees. They hate that. They hate that. They think that we are supposed to be, as one Zionist said, waiters and woodcutters. They, in the Zionist imagination, we are meant to be a cheap labor force. Mm-hmm. How dare us become professionals? How dare us be writers and creatives and intellectuals? How dare us have modern buildings and cultural institutions and writing salons and museums? And how dare us? They cannot abide that. And it is no accident that Israel, one of the first places they went after were the universities. They particularly occupied the universities and then detonated them. We've all seen the footage of soldiers detonating the Islamic University of Gaza, Al-Azhar University. Every single institution of higher learning has been utterly decimated.
Well, the things that you're talking about are so shocking, and it really brings me, when you, I was listening to you, wondering, well, you speak eloquently about what has happened. You really depict a picture that is out there that is not only not covered as much as it should, but rather misunderstood because the West in particular, generally speaking, and in particular their media organizations, obviously want to change the narrative against some of the things that you have said. I'm wondering if there was enough coverage the way you just described the realities, whether we would be looking at a different landscape, although I think that the landscape has changed in terms of the views that people generally have on the Israeli regime.
So absolutely. I mean, Western media have largely acted as stenographers for Israel. And if you look at the owners and the advertisers and the editors at these media outlets, they are Zionist ideologues in large part. Sometimes they're even Mossad agents, as the head of the Middle Eastern Bureau of the BBC, for example. That has been a big scandal, and he's still there. He's still deciding the coverage of what's happening. But however, the difference now is that there are other media outlets that are accessible to the West, and so it becomes harder to gatekeep information. Media outlets like yours, like Press TV, Electronic Intifada, and so many other independent media outlets and journalists who have been covering this with a conscience and with fact and truth. I think, however, in general, across the board, people tend to focus on this moment in isolation. Even, you know, it's kind of, you know, people generally start with October 7th. And even though there are a lot, some media outlets have pushed back and said this goes back to 48, I think it's important to view this in a much larger frame, not just Palestinian history, but the history in the region, to look at the kind of propaganda that Zionists have promulgated. Even if you look at Iraq, for example, the way the misinformation, the propaganda, the way that media outlets lined up just, you know, to as stenographers for Israel, despite an iota of evidence to destroy and dismantle one of the oldest civilizations in the world.
Indeed.
To reduce a high-functioning, frankly, glorious society, even under a dictator. Iraq was glorious. It was stunning. And they have utterly dismantled it. They have broken the backbone of the society. They're intellectuals, they're writers, they're teachers, they're doctors and engineers, and created utter despair and chaos that has persisted and will persist for generations before they can. And this was all, this was